From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! A judge rules against two British activists who accuse McDonald's of being unhealthy, environmentally destructive, and anti-labor. But the activists say the trial vindicates them.
We feel that they should be paying damages to the public for the harm that they do to children through exploiting them through advertising, through, you know, they should be paying damages to their employees because they've been ripping them off for years by paying them low wages and preventing them from, you know, joining unions and getting organised to fight for a better deal. We think it's McDonald's that should be paying the damages and not us.
Yeah, but the judge doesn't think that, so where does that leave you?
Well, we're not paying. I mean, it's as simple as that, you know. We haven't got the money, and we don't think McDonald's deserve it.
And as Britain prepares to hand Hong Kong back to China, we take a journey with travel writer Paul Theroux back to the Opium Wars through a century of British colonial rule. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. The newly named Summit of the Eight officially begins this evening in Denver. It used to be called the G7, the leaders of the world's top industrial countries plus Russia. President Clinton has asked Russian President Boris Yeltsin to lead off the discussion with his own assessment of the global economy. This celebration of globalization will be countered in the city by another event called TOES, the Other Economic Summit. Tobacco talks are down to the details. Negotiators say they're making steady progress on the multi-billion dollar settlement. The end agreement would impose unprecedented restrictions on cigarettes and spell the demise of Joe Camel and the Marlboro Man. The deal would also settle 40 state lawsuits that seek to recover Medicaid money spent treating smokers. Joe Camel and the Marlboro Man would disappear from tobacco ads, and smokers could get free medical help to kick the habit. But international anti-smoking activists continue to demand that they be included in the settlement. Congress is keeping the ban on abortions at U.S. military hospitals overseas. The House voted 224 to 196 against allowing privately paid abortions at the hospitals. Abortions are prohibited at military hospitals in this country, but patients have other options. That's not always the case overseas. California Democrat Ron Dellums argued that American servicewomen overseas deserve the rights they're assigned to protect. A son of Martin Luther King Jr. said he believes his father's assassination was part of a government conspiracy that the late President Lyndon Johnson must have known about. Dexter King said on ABC's Turning Point last night, "Based on the evidence that I've been shown, I would think that it would be very difficult for something of that magnitude to occur on his watch and he not be privy to it." The number of programs allowing drug addicts to exchange dirty needles for clean ones is growing in the United States, and nearly half of them are illegal, this according to the government. There were 87 needle exchanges in 71 cities in 1995-96, this according to the Centers for Disease Control. It's a 45% increase from the 60 programs in 46 cities a year earlier. Exxon Corporation is saying that it will appeal the $5 billion January judgment against the company for the 1989 Valdez oil spill. Exxon says it would base its appeal on juror misconduct, jury instructions, compensatory damage errors, and what it referred to as the excessiveness of punitive damages in the case. This news from Harare, Zimbabwe. A World Forum on Endangered Species lifted a 7-year-old global ban in ivory trade to allow 3 southern African states to conditionally sell ivory to Japan from their excess elephant herds. The 10-day Convention on International Trade in Endangered Species backed an experimental deal worked out Wednesday by a 19-member committee after the conference had been bogged down in acrimonious debate over what many saw as demands for loose trade that could endanger elephants worldwide. And you're listening to Democracy Now! It's been one of the longest trials in British legal history, pitting the $30 billion corporate giant, McDonald's, against two activists, part-time bartender Helen Steele and former postal worker David Morris. Yesterday, a London judge ruled that the two activists had libeled McDonald's when they handed out a fact sheet 7 years ago called What's Wrong with McDonald's? The pamphlet criticized the food chain's environmental record and questioned the nutritional value of burgers and fries. But after a 3-year trial and 6 months of deliberation, the judge only awarded McDonald's about $185,000 in damages and in many areas agreed with some of the defendants' criticisms. Joining us today from London to talk about the case is Helen Steele, one of the activists who was sued by McDonald's. Helen, what's your reaction to the judge's verdict?
Basically, the verdict was quite amazing. I mean, despite overwhelming odds being stacked against us, having been denied a jury trial, not having any legal experience and being up against the top legal team, the complete imbalance of resources between the two parties, you know, McDonald's are a $30 billion a year corporation and we between us have an income of less than £7,500 a year. Despite all that, the judge has basically found McDonald's guilty of exploiting children through their advertising techniques, of being responsible for cruelty to animals that are reared to produce the burgers, that they pay low wages to their workers and help to depress wage rates in the catering industry, that they're anti-union, and that when they advertise their food as nutritious, that is deceptive. So I think, you know, our stand in fighting this case has really been vindicated. And also, if people actually read the judgment, which is available online on the McSpotlight internet site, they can see for themselves that all the criticisms were valid and were backed up by the evidence in the case. And really, the parts that we lost the verdict on were basically because of legal interpretation of the exact meaning, taking into account things like cartoons and satirical banner headlines, which we argued that people don't take literally anyway. You know, actually, that's one side of the case that we are very concerned about, that, you know, satirical speech and cartoons are under threat if this judgment is held to be reasonable on appeal.
Let's see, I'm looking at the front page of the Washington Post, so you've certainly made it there. It talks about, of course, this David and Goliath case, and it says that the trial produced evidence that McDonald's hens and chickens and some pigs were given insufficient room during portions of their short lives, that the company was culpably responsible for a cruel practice in at least some instances in which some chickens were still conscious when their throats were slit. He upheld the claim that McDonald's advertising makes considerable use of susceptible young children to entice them in. So why did you lose if the judge ruled in your favor in these cases?
Well, I mean, basically, the parts that we lost, it was really on legal technicalities and the extreme interpretation that the judge decided on the meaning of the leaflet, which we argue if people actually look at the leaflet for themselves, they will see that the leaflet doesn't have that meaning. For example, in the nutrition section of the leaflet, you know, during the closing speeches, the judge actually agreed that the text of the leaflet was fine, but that because of satirical banner headlines saying McDeadly, McCancer, McGarbage, McRipoff, McDollars, which were really just taking the mickey out of, you know, McDonald's habit of prefixing everything with Merck, and also because of a cartoon of a cow and a person in a bun saying if the slaughterhouse doesn't get you, the junk food will, that had upped the meaning of the actual text and meant that we had to prove something much stronger than what the leaflet actually said. And so, you know, on the nutrition section, the judgment went against us, even though the judge actually ruled that their food was high in fat and low in fibre. He also ruled that a diet high in fat and low in fibre was linked with an increased risk of heart disease, and he also ruled that it was deceptive for McDonald's to advertise their food as nutritious when in reality it wasn't. So this is what I mean when I say that if people actually go to the judgment and to the transcripts of all the evidence in the case, which are available on the McSpotlight internet site, they can see for themselves that actually all the evidence in the case does back up all the criticisms that were made in the fact sheet.
The judge also ruled, and this is highlighted in the New York Times front page article with the headline, "Golden Arches Are Victorious But Bloodied in a British Court," that it's true that McDonald's low wages in Britain tended to depress salaries in the fast food industry.
That's right. But despite saying that, he then ruled against us on the employment issue. And, I can only say again that so much of the evidence went in our favour and was found in our favour in the judgment, but ultimately, you know, on legal technicalities to do with exact interpretation of meaning, he decided against us. For example, he decided that, yes, they do pay low wages, and yes, that they're anti-union. But he then turned around and said that it wasn't, you know, that we'd lost on that issue. And he said that although they're anti-union, that didn't mean that they had a policy of preventing unionisation by getting rid of pro-union employees. And this was despite the fact that McDonald's vice president for this country actually gave evidence in the witness box that no overt union activity was allowed on McDonald's premises, and that anything like handing out leaflets or getting together for a union meeting or speaking about those kind of things would be a summary sackable offence for a crew member at McDonald's. So, you know, really we find it astounding that the judge ruled against us on this issue.
For our listeners who aren't familiar with the case, Helen Steele, we did have you on before when you were in the midst of the trial, but can you go back and explain to us what exactly happened? What did McDonald's take you to court for?
McDonald's alleged that we were responsible for distributing a leaflet produced by London Greenpeace in the mid-1980s, which criticised McDonald's for exploitation of their workers, of children through their advertising, of damaging the environment through the wasteful and harmful effects of the mountains of packaging that they used, and through the effects of cattle ranching, of promoting unhealthy food that, you know, of a type that, where if you have a diet of that type, it's linked to heart disease and cancer, about the connections between multinational companies like McDonald's and cash crops and starvation in the third world. The way that animals are reared and slaughtered, basically the barbaric way that animals are reared and slaughtered for McDonald's products and for the meat industry generally. They sent private investigators into London Greenpeace to find out who was attending meetings. And then after about a year of that, they served writs on myself and my co-defendant.
And three other people who eventually apologized and pulled out of the case, is that right?
That's right. I mean, when we initially got the libel writs, obviously we had no idea about what the libel laws were, or, you know, we'd never really heard of it before. We went to lawyers to get advice, and they said to us, you know, you'll be banging your heads against a brick wall. The entire burden of proof in the UK in libel cases is upon the defendants, and you can't just prove your case by reference to, you know, authoritative journals and scientific documents and so on. You actually have to call experts on each of the issues. And they said that, you know, to fight a libel case as a defendant at the best of times was extremely difficult, but that with no legal experience and no resources to be able to pay for representation, we were really on a hiding to nothing. And it was most likely that, you know, our case would fall on some technical failing in meeting all the pretrial procedures before the case even got to court, and we'd be left with a massive bill. And really faced with that, the other three felt they had no option but to apologise. In a similar way that McDonald's have actually succeeded in intimidating the vast majority of their critics in this country into silence, well, in terms of the sort of larger organisations and media bodies, they've been intimidated into silence because of the oppressive nature of the UK libel laws. And, you know, we just really felt, well, it's about time that somebody stood up to them and defended the public's right to criticize multinational companies.
So you have no amendment like ours, the Freedom of Speech Amendment, the First Amendment?
No, that's right. freedom of speech is not protected in this country, and that's one thing that we're intending to take our case to the European Court of Human Rights to demand that that multinationals should no longer have the right to sue for libel, you know, which would really just bring the UK into line with the US, whereas I understand it, before a company like McDonald's could get a case off the ground, they would have to show that, you know, the statements had been fabricated, which McDonald's clearly couldn't have done in this case because, you know, their own witness, who's on the board of directors for McDonald's, gave evidence that all the issues in our case were actually in the public domain in America anyway, and, you know, the company had been criticized for similar things in the U.S., and he agreed that they couldn't, you know, they hadn't taken action over there, and they couldn't do because of the protection of freedom of speech. Additionally, you know, to this point of multinationals not being able to sue for libel, I mean, about 4 years ago, the UK's highest court, the House of Lords, actually ruled that governmental bodies in this country wouldn't be able to sue for libel because they recognised that it did inhibit freedom of speech and deter people from making criticism. And they said that, you know, it was in the interest of democracy and the public's right to know what was going on in these institutions of power that people did feel uninhibited about making criticisms which they felt were valid. And really, you know, we feel that this should be extended to multinational companies because they have just as much, well, they have just as much and often more power and influence in society today of governmental bodies, and they're even less accountable. So it's absolutely vital that they're subject to detailed public scrutiny of their business practices.
We're talking to Helen Steele, one of the two co-defendants in the McLibel case. A decision was handed down yesterday by the judge, which, well, in a sense they were victorious, although ultimately he ruled against them. It was a long case, one of the longest in British history. The court heard from 180 witnesses, sat for 313 days over 2.5 years, and generated 60,000 pages of transcripts and other documents. Can you briefly go through with us who you called to the stand over these more than 300 days?
Well, we called witnesses to back up all of the criticisms that were made in the leaflet. We basically went back to the movements that had made the original criticisms that had been brought together in the London Greenpeace fact sheet. And we called nutritionists, trade unionists, environmentalists, animal welfare experts, and so on. McDonald's, for their part, called out all their big guns and executives, heads of department, consultants, and so on. And, you know, it was a real eye-opening experience being able to cross-examine them in the witness box and get to, you know, get to the inner workings of the company and get them out in the open.
Can you talk about the McDonald's executives who talk about Coca-Cola and the one you challenged on waste?
Well, it was quite incredible. We cross-examined top executives as to what they meant when they claimed that McDonald's food was nutritious, you know, when they advertised it in that way. And when we asked David Green, who's McDonald's Senior Vice President of Marketing, what he meant by nutritious, he said that it means that it's providing nutrients. And he admitted that that could basically apply to a packet of sweets. And when we actually asked him if Coca-Cola could be described as nutritious, he turned around and said that, quote, "it is providing water, and I think that is part of a balanced diet," unquote, which is just incredible. And he agreed that by his definition, Coke was nutritious. And, yeah, another example was when we cross-examined Ed Oakley, who's a chief purchasing officer for McDonald's UK and Europe. He was talking about the use of landfill sites, and he said that there was no landfill problem in the UK. So we asked him, as you know, whether that meant by saying that he thought that as long as there is room in the dumps, there is no problem with dumping lots of McDonald's waste in the ground. And he said, "and everybody else's waste, yes, that is true." And in actual fact, he then went on to say, "I can see the dumping of waste to be a benefit. Otherwise, you will end up with lots of vast empty gravel pits all over the country." which is, you know, just amazing. And he actually went on to say, you know, we said, are you asserting that it's an environmental benefit to dump waste in landfill sites? And he said, it could be. Yes, it's certainly not a problem. And, you know, I think really these two are just, you know, examples of how desperate McDonald's situation was. They were, you know, basically trying to defend the indefensible.
Helen Steele, we're going to be back with you in a minute again. Helen Steele, sued by McDonald's. Judge found in McDonald's favor, though the activists feel that, in fact, they were victorious. We'll be back with the conversation with Helen after this break here on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! You're listening to Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman, and we're continuing our conversation with Helen Steele, an English activist being sued by McDonald's for allegedly distributing a six-page leaflet that criticized the company's environmental record and the nutritional value of McDonald's food. In fact, they admit to distributing that leaflet, more than 2 million of them, but they say that they were telling the truth and continue to say that despite the judge's finding. Helen, I was very interested in one of the witnesses that you brought forward. You asked his view of the statement contained in the Greenpeace fact sheet, which said this: a diet high in fat, sugar, animal products and salt, and low in fiber, vitamins and minerals is linked with cancer of the breast and bowel and heart disease. McDonald's cancer expert replied, if it's being directed to the public, then I would say it's a very reasonable thing to say. So you were victorious there in that line of questioning.
Yeah, I mean, that really just showed up how ridiculous McDonald's position was. You know, here they were suing us for saying that a high-fat, low-fiber diet was linked to heart disease and cancer, and their own expert was agreeing with it. And, you know, to me, that just shows how ridiculous the UK libel laws are, that McDonald's should be able to bring a case on totally spurious grounds and force us into great expense and a huge amount of our time. In order to defend it.
I don't think I knew about the food poisoning cases. McDonald's admitting that they were responsible for an outbreak of E. coli food poisoning in the United States in 1982 and in Britain in 1991, in which people suffered serious kidney failure.
Well, it's certainly something that McDonald's have tried to keep under wraps. I mean, they admitted it in our case, the Preston incident, where people suffered serious kidney failure as a result of eating McDonald's burgers. You know, the company hadn't admitted that to the people who were affected by, you know, the food poisoning and who sued McDonald's. McDonald's made an out-of-court settlement and wouldn't admit liability. But when we tracked down one of those people and said that we would be calling them as a witness, all of a sudden McDonald's made a formal admission confirming that they were indeed responsible for that outbreak of food poisoning. you know, basically they said in court that that was to avoid any publicity on the issue. They didn't want this person to come to court to give evidence about, you know, the horrific experience that she'd been through after eating a McDonald's hamburger and suffering E. coli food poisoning. I mean, I don't know. To me, it's just completely incredible that that McDonald's can sue over this issue of food poisoning when, you know, they have had two major outbreaks of food poisoning, and they've also had other smaller incidents. In this country, there was another example where a three-year-old girl was, obviously her mother, she was with her mother, but she was served a chicken McNuggets which had salmonella, and that they were undercooked, and the local environmental health body actually took McDonald's to court and said that the food was unfit for human consumption. And obviously, if she'd gone ahead and eaten that chicken McNugget, then she could have got salmonella poisoning. And it's just completely ridiculous that McDonald's can sue us for pointing out the obvious, which is that there is a risk of food poisoning from, you know, meat-based products, which is basically all that the leaflet says.
Helen, ultimately, how did you do this? You had worked in a bar for your income. Dave Morris was a single parent and an ex-postman. How did you manage this over these years?
Well, we've really, in terms of the legal procedures, we've really had to learn on our feet. We had 28 pretrial hearings, where we got to learn a bit about the way the courts operate. And over time, we learnt about all the documents and filing and so on that had to be done. And then on the other side of things, the financial side, I mean, the support campaign raised between £35,000 and £40,000 to pay for the cost of getting our witnesses to court, you know, their airfares, because they came from all over the world, the cost of phone bills and photocopying bills, and just all the expenses that are involved with the court case. And really, without, you know, huge and overwhelming public support, we could never have fought this case. You know, it's the support of the public that's enabled us to carry on.
So where do you go from here? You've been doing this for 3 years.
Well, the campaign continues. McDonald's aim in bringing this campaign was to silence its critics. That's completely backfired. And in fact, since the writs were served on us, over 2 million What's Wrong with McDonald's leaflets have been handed out in this country alone. And in fact, tomorrow, on Saturday, there's going to be a victory day of action to celebrate McDonald's complete failure to silence their critics and to continue getting these issues aired to the public so that they can judge for themselves whether or not they want these multinationals having such power and influence in society. And on the legal front, we intend to appeal on the parts of the judgment that we lost, and we intend to take the UK government to the European Court of Human Rights, basically over the completely unfair and oppressive nature of the UK libel laws. The denial of legal aid, the denial of a jury trial, the total imbalance of resources, and the other issue which I mentioned earlier about multinationals shouldn't have the right to sue for libel. So the campaign is basically continuing on all fronts.
And what about this $98,000 libel award to McDonald's? Do you and David have to pay it?
Well, I mean, we haven't got any money anyway, but if we had, we certainly wouldn't pay it to McDonald's, and we don't think that they deserve a penny. We feel that they should be paying damages to the public for the harm that they do to children through exploiting them through advertising, through, you know, they should be paying damages to their employees because they've been ripping them off for years by paying them low wages and preventing them from, you know, joining unions and getting organized to fight for a better deal. We think it's McDonald's that should be paying the damages and not us.
Yeah, but the judge doesn't think that. So where does that leave you?
Well, we're not paying. I mean, it's as simple as that, you know. We haven't got the money, and we don't think McDonald's deserve it.
Helen Steele, we want to thank you very much for joining us. English activists sued by McDonald's for distributing a leaflet outside McDonald's that criticized the company's environmental record, nutritional value of McDonald's food. If you want more information, you can go to the internet where they have a website. It's www.mcspotlight.org. That's www.mcspotlight.org. Tomorrow, activists around the world will be leafleting McDonald's. Also, if you'd like to get a copy of today's show, you can call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230.
In the daytime, I'm Mr. Natural, just as healthy as I can be. But at night, I'm a junk food junkie. Good Lord, have pity on me. My friends down at the commune, they think I'm pretty neat. I don't know a thing about their arts and crafts, but I give them all something to eat. I was a friend of old Yule Gibbons, rest his soul, I only eat homegrown spice. I got a John Keats autographed Grecian urn filled up with my brown rice, you know I do. But lately I have been spotted with a Big Mac on my breath. Stumbling into a Colonel Sanders with a face as white as death. I'm afraid someday they'll find me just stretched out on my bed with a handful of Pringles potato chips and a ding-dong by my head. In the daytime, I'm Mr. Natural, just as healthy as I can be. But at night, I'm a junk food junkie. Good Lord, have pity on me.
That from Wacky Classics of the 70s, Junk Food Junkie. And you're listening to Democracy Now! I won't even try to make a transition here. On June 30th, after nearly a century, British colonial rule of Hong Kong will officially come to an end. And on July 1st, the People's Republic of China will formally incorporate the capitalist metropolis into a special administrative district of Beijing. But under the one country, two systems formula, Hong Kong will retain its existing economic character. Today, we're pleased to be joined by travel writer Paul Theroux, who's just published a novel of Hong Kong called Kowloon Tong. He also wrote a long piece for The New Yorker last month about Hong Kong, the history of British rule in the colony, and the transition to Beijing. In just a minute, we'll be joined by Willem van Kemenade, a freelance journalist and correspondent for NRC Handelsblad, a major Dutch newspaper. He's covered East Asia, including China, Taiwan, and Hong Kong for the last 20 years and just published a new book called China, Hong Kong, Taiwan, Inc. Well, why don't we begin with you, Paul Theroux. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thanks very much.
I thought that the piece you did in The New Yorker about a month ago called Hong Kong Ghost Stories really gave a very important history of Hong Kong. As people talk about looking at the future, we clearly have to first look at the past century of British colonial rule. How did Britain come to be in Hong Kong?
Through the Opium Wars. And the reason why it's really important for us to understand it is because it's on the Chinese mind all the time. I mean, the Chinese are obsessed with the fact that they were humiliated throughout the 18th and 19th century by foreigners, traders, pirates, soldiers, navy people who were basically trying to trade with them and force opium down their throats. The British had bought a lot of tea from China. They developed such an obsession or compulsion to drink tea that they began to owe the Chinese a lot of money. And partly to rectify this and also to prop up the British Empire in India, they devised a method of selling large amounts of opium. Opium had always been sold in China by the Portuguese and other people. But the idea was to export a lot of opium to China. And the Opium War was really the beginning of India as a great power, Britain as a great power, great sea power and great trading power. But also it was the demise of China and the rise of Hong Kong, because the Chinese resisted. They said, we don't want this opium. In a word, they resisted it. The British forced it on them and then actually went to war in 1838.
I mean, it's an unbelievable story. I mean, the British just forced drugs on China.
Yeah, it is an amazing story. But, I mean, most imperial powers are just rackets. I mean, what were we doing in Vietnam, what were we doing? A lot of companies were involved selling, selling goods and services there. It's all about making money. The Portuguese were in Angola for how long? 400 years. Go to Angola. Look at the roads there. They're terrible. The schools terrible. Even when the Portuguese were running, everything was terrible. What's the point? The point is they were mining diamonds there, and as a result, Portugal is was quite a prosperous place. And all over Lisbon, you can see buildings that were built with the profits of Africans digging diamonds out of the ground in Angola, which is now, you know, it's still at war. Hong Kong has a similar bloody and ridiculous imperial history. It seems to be one of the features of imperialism that it does this to people, and that it's basically a racket. So the idea that it's opium, it's something we can understand because the drug trade is on our minds. If people think about drugs, they think about cocaine and how it affects daily life. It's as though the Colombians were forcing us to buy cocaine, and if we didn't buy it, they'd go to war. And then the Chinese had to pay an indemnity, quite a lot of money, and also had to hand over Hong Kong to the British as a trophy, which was ridiculed. I mean, no one liked it. It was just seen as a...
Wait, explain that. Why did that happen?
Because there was no profit to be had in Hong Kong in 1841 when the treaty was signed. Queen Victoria just looked at it and she said, oh, she made a joke. She said, maybe I'll be the queen of Hong Kong too, ha, ha, ha. And it wasn't. It was just an island with about 2,000 people and fishing villages. It wasn't until a bit later that Hong Kong developed, in the Second Opium War, as a matter of fact, a bit of coastline. And then they annexed in 1898 a lot of Kowloon, where my novel takes place, and the new territories. That 1898 was another treaty. But that was actually a rental agreement. That's a sort of rent control business, and that's the treaty that has come up for expiration this year.
But it wasn't just the British who were involved with the Opium Wars. The British got a lot of other imperial countries involved.
Every country, every trading country in the world was involved to some extent because the future of trade with China rested on it. The issue wasn't just selling opium to China. It was also opening up China to the world for trade. China did not allow a trade to be handled. They didn't like foreigners. They didn't trust them, and with good reason. Look what they were doing. But the British made a free trade issue out of it. And so as a result of this treaty, a number of treaty ports were open. I mean, the ports that we know and love today. Xiamen is one. Willem Kamenade actually mentions Xiamen in his book. And many other treaty ports. There were ports where foreigners lived, and they were entry points. Until then, opium was smuggled into China and sneaked in, smuggled in. And every country, the Dutch, the Portuguese, everyone, the Americans, we had a lot to gain by the Britain's victory in the Opium War. And, of course, that's the founding of Hong Kong, a big cloud of purple poppy smoke.
We're going to continue this discussion after a break, and I want to let people know you can call in and we'll be playing some of your comments if you call us at 202-588-0999, extension 313. That's 202-588-0999, extension 313. And you can also write to us on the internet by writing to democracy@pacifica.org. We're talking to Paul Theroux. He wrote an interesting piece in New Yorker magazine called Letter from Hong Kong, Ghost Stories, and has written many different travel books, I guess you could call them, including one called Riding the Iron Rooster by Train Through China. When we come back, we'll also be joined by William Van Kemenade, who's written the book China, Hong Kong, Taiwan, and the dynamics of a new empire. And I want to ask him, having lived in China for a couple of decades now, what is the reaction of the people in China specifically as they look back through the Opium Wars and then look forward right now in this next week to the taking over of Hong Kong or the handing over of Hong Kong back to China. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, which is heard from Hawaii to Maine, from Washington to Florida, from California to New York, and a number of cities in between. And if you've got friends around the country who can't hear Democracy Now!, you should tell them to call their public radio station and ask them to air it. But they can also go to the net, because as of last week, we are online. We are on Real Audio, and they can listen to Democracy Now! By going to our website at pacifica.org. That's www.pacifica.org. We'll be back here on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! In 60 seconds. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman, as we continue the discussion about Hong Kong and the handover to China on June 30th. We're joined by travel writer Paul Theroux, did a very interesting piece in The New Yorker called Hong Kong Ghost Stories, and Willem van Kemenade. He's written the book China, Hong Kong, Taiwan, Inc., The Dynamics of a New Empire. What about in your time in China that you've spent over the last few decades, Willem van Kemenade, the reaction of the Chinese to the whole British imperial history of Hong Kong and also in China?
Of course, the resumption of sovereignty. I have an echo, I'm sorry. The resumption of Chinese sovereignty over Hong Kong.
Why don't you just take off your headphones and it won't bother you as much?
The resumption of sovereignty over Hong Kong will be a very grand historical occasion, an epochal event which symbolizes the renaissance of the Chinese nation, the reestablishment of China as the preeminent power in East Asia. They are beating the drum of nationalism, of glory, of the ultimate retreat of the imperialists. The era of colonialism in Asia will finally end. Apart from this small little Portuguese outpost of Macau, there are no Western occupied territories in Asia anymore. But may I add a point to what Paul Theroux just said about the Opium War? The Chinese, of course, will make this into a major, unprecedented propaganda event. And what Mr. Theroux said about the Opium War is all true, of course, but it's not a complete picture. The Opium War could only flourish because there was a vast class of corrupt merchants and mandarins of the Chinese Empire who facilitated that opium trade, who acted as compradors, as go-betweens, and who took enormous profits of this opium trade, and even billions of dollars of the profits of this opium trade went directly to the imperial court in Beijing, where one of the most powerful emperors in Chinese history, Emperor Qianlong, reigned and received British embassies who came to supplicate to establish legal trade relations and do open trade, of which the Chinese didn't want to have anything. So the British, in order to pay for all the tea and the silk and to finance the government of British India, they expanded that opium trade to get revenue, both indeed to pay for the imports of tea and the financing of their colonial government in India.
Willem van Kemenade, what about the agreement now that has been reached? The agreement now being reached between business people in China and the government of China and the business people of Hong Kong. What is this agreement?
Well, Chinese leaders have always stressed that Hong Kong should be an economic city, a city without politics, because politics are divisive, and if you have a government made up by elected politicians, they introduce all kinds of popular measures like social welfare, etc. There hardly exists any in Hong Kong. Hong Kong should remain a highly competitive financial transportation center where multinationals, the banks of the world, the airlines, the shipping lines, etc., can operate in a highly efficient way and serve the modernization of China. So what you see is that basically Hong Kong is going to be a subsidiary of this huge Chinese state, which has also become in recent years a depoliticized economic state with a single-minded pursuit of economic growth and, well, strengthen China's economy, becoming a powerful and prosperous country. This is the historical goal of China. China always has stated since the 1860s that its historical ideal is to become a powerful and strong country, not a democratic country.
You're listening to Willem van Kemenade. He is author of a new book that's been published by Knopf, China, Hong Kong, Taiwan, Inc., The Dynamics of a New Empire. And we're joined by Paul Theroux. Paul, would you like to respond?
Oh, yes. No, I agree. Hello, Willem.
I
found everything that you said interesting. My question is, because in my novel, Kowloon Tong, I tried to put an imaginative interpretation on this. When you talk about the Chinese ambition for Hong Kong to be a financial center, I agree. I agree with everything you said. I'm sure that ambition is what it is. But is it possible for Hong Kong to be a financial center if there's limited press freedom? If there isn't a free flow of information, how is it possible for it, for say stock market quotes, if there's an element of manipulation in the press, in the media generally, how is it possible for it to be preeminent as a financial center? Have the Chinese seen the contradiction there, do you think?
Well, the Chinese have not explicitly clamped down on press freedom so far. The only thing they have announced is curbing of civil liberties, limitations on the right to demonstrate. As you know, over the last 5 years, particularly during the governorship of Chris Patten, a culture of almost daily demonstrations has developed. And the plutocrats, the commercial oligarchy of Hong Kong, would very much like to see these demonstrations limited. And the worrying thing is that these limitations on demonstrations will be imposed in the name of national security. And national security, of course, in a communist country that China officially still is, has a totally different meaning than it has in Western democracies. So what is worrying is that this may open the gate for the police to clamp down on dissent on the democratic camp. And, well, we have to wait and see how this will manifest itself in practice. It is a worrying phenomenon.
I was thinking more, general press freedom. If they're limiting it in one area, they're likely to limit it in another. The Independent Commission Against Corruption, which has been pretty busy under the British, the Chinese will keep that Commission Against Corruption ticking over with the same sort of lack of interference? And two, what about the Court of Final Appeal? If businesses don't have a Supreme Court or a Court of Final Appeal to take a case to, they're all going to be based like Jardines in Bermuda, and it'll basically be an interim port of transaction. In other words, a business doesn't want to take a lot of risks in a place where they don't have any idea of getting justice in the courts.
Well, there have been quite a few items of very positive news exactly on the topics that you just mentioned. One of the most respected independent-minded barristers of Hong Kong, Andrew Lee, has been appointed Chief Justice of the Court of Final Appeal a few weeks ago. This was widely hailed as excellent news for the continuation of an independent judiciary, and even Chris Patten himself, he praised replaced both Andrew Lee and his appointment to Chief Justice as the best guarantee for the preservation of the British legal system and the rule of law in the SAR under Chinese sovereignty. So it's not, the news is all that bad. The other items that you mentioned, ICAC, the Independent Commission Against Corruption, it will be preserved. Whether it will have the clout and the wherewithal in the future, and then I mean in the mid-long-term future, to clamp down on corrupt practices by politically well-connected, powerful state businessmen from China, who will try to use the connections of the party networks, of their fathers who are senior members of the Politburo, etc. That remains to be seen. But for the time being, the Independent Commission Against Corruption will very much continue, and it has assured in press conference in recent weeks that nothing will change, that Hong Kong will remain a level playing field where no special deals will be permitted.
Don't you think a lot of businessmen...
Hong Kong, the new Hong Kong will not start with the handover, of course. Only at least after a year you have to look at it to make up the balance. What came true of all these assurances, and even in 1 year it won't be clear. I guess the year 2000 would be the best moment to make a preliminary assessment whether the SAR will have been a success.
Writers Willem van Kemenade and Paul Theroux are our guests, talking about Hong Kong and China, a place both of them have spent a good amount of time. Willem van Kemenade has lived there for the last couple of decades, and Paul Theroux has been in and out over the last few decades. Paul, one of the things you point out in your New Yorker piece is that it's not as if they're going from democracy to something else, because the British certainly haven't maintained a real democracy in Hong Kong, though in the last year they've sort of started to put in the structures of it. And there's a lot of bitterness on the part of the Chinese to say, you know, you're saying it's going away from this. You never had this.
That's true. When you say they haven't maintained it, there has been no democracy. It was run just like a business. And
what do you mean?
People were appointed. The governor appointed people to his council, and small municipal posts were appointed. There were no municipal elections. Civics wasn't taught in Hong Kong schools. There was no democracy. But I mean, quite an interesting point is that in most cases a colony gets independence. I 30 odd years ago, I was in the Peace Corps in Nyasaland, which a few months later became the Independent Republic of Malawi. Then wife was in Kenya. That Kenya became independent. Tanzania became independent. Of course, we know India became independent. Many countries which were now republics had been British colonies. Hong Kong was a crown colony. China never recognized the treaties, but the treaties weren't made with Deng Xiaoping. They were made with an imperial government in the 19th century. So why, if you assume that the treaties were meaningless, as the Chinese said they were, why didn't Hong Kong become independent? You would have thought that it would. I mean, this is the question is, why is this happening? I know that any political scientist can tell me in real terms why Hong Kong is going back to the Chinese, but the British never consulted the Hong Kong people on their future. And under Chinese pressure in 1971, they dropped Hong Kong from a list of countries to be decolonized. So I think the whole thing was railroaded and it was kind of a lot of political connivance with it. So it's a very, very strange thing. The fact that they didn't have any democracy, well, they didn't have any democracy in Nyasaland. They didn't have any in northern Rhodesia, but then it became Zambia. You know, the fact that it didn't have democracy is kind of irrelevant because, generally speaking, colonies don't.
You write also about a number of human rights activists and their concerns now. You choose particularly to focus on Martin Lee. Can you talk about him and what he has done in Hong Kong?
Martin Lee is a Queen's Counsel, that is a barrister. So he has a very legalistic mind. He also is a very scrupulous man. And he decided to run when they finally did have an election. He formed the Democratic Party, was one of the founders of the Democratic Party there, which got many seats in the elected legislative council, which has been dissolved by the Chinese. He feels that Willem told me something that I didn't know, that a man called Andrew Lee is going to be Chief Justice of the Court of Final Appeal. Yeah, that's news to me, and that's good news. I think Martin Lee might also welcome it. I would be interested to know what Martin Lee actually felt about it. I suppose he would welcome it because everyone welcomes an equivalent of some kind of a Supreme Court. But Martin Lee is a very high-profile critic of the Chinese and of the British too for the way that things have been handled, and he's has been very outspoken on all these issues of law and the democratic process, which has been phased out. This democratic process has been phased out.
And does he think things will be better or worse under the Chinese? And would he like to see an independent Hong Kong?
If I asked him about an independent Hong Kong, it's too late to even think about that. It's like thinking about an independent California. California was also a treaty, and Texas was too. These are all treaties, you know, in the 19th century. But Hong Kong is an accident of history, I suppose. But what he would like to see is the rule of law, and there are a lot of loopholes. Article 23, in the basic law. Sounds boring to talk about, but it actually it's very interesting. It's the law of subversion. I would be interested to know what you think, how the Chinese will implement Article 23, where if you say the wrong thing, print the wrong thing, assemble in the wrong place, you're a subversive, you're trying to overthrow the government, you'll be sent to a pig farm in Mongolia, probably.
Well, there are two things. One is the curbing of civil liberties, the limits on the right to demonstrate. Another one is a ban on foreign funding for political groups in Hong Kong. That will affect trade unions, for instance, who get support from ILO, perhaps Amnesty International. Martin Lee will not be allowed to receive foreign funding anymore. As you know, during his triumphal journey to the United States recently, he collected $260,000 just during one fundraising dinner. This will all be banned, of course. But the other even more ominous thing is, indeed, you refer to it, Clause 23 of the Basic Law. The Basic Law is the constitution for the special administrative region, and that requires to pass a number of organic laws on the details. So the Legislative Council of the SAR has to make laws concerning state secrets, subversion, sedition, and all kinds of things that do not exist anymore in Western free countries. So this Clause 23 actually was introduced into the Basic Law that was being drafted from 85 to 90 after the crackdown on Tiananmen Square, because that created so much paranoia among the Chinese leadership that Hong Kong could emerge into a base for subversion, a democratic enclave in China that would be used for evangelism of democracy in what is still communist China. And therefore, that Clause 23 was introduced into it. And the detailed legislation with all these provisions on these draconian communist concepts, these laws still have to be made. And that will be done most probably only after the elections. It is not the case that the Chinese are going to roll back democracy completely in Hong Kong. They are only going to delay it. The Basic Law provides for a timetable. There will be elections for a legislative council. They will not be as free as the elections were that the British held in 1995. They will disfavor Martin Lee a bit. Actually, I met Martin a few weeks ago, and I asked him what he expected of the elections in 1998, and he expected that his party would still get 13 seats, down from 19 in the 1995 elections.
William van Kemenade, I want to thank you very much for joining us, as well as Paul Theroux. William van Kemenade's book is called China, Hong Kong, Taiwan, Inc., The Dynamics of a New Empire. It's brand new. It's published by Knopf. We've also been joined by Paul Theroux, who has written a number of books, but most recently, his novel is called Kowloon Tong, A Novel of Hong Kong. Thank you for joining us.
My pleasure. Thanks.
Democracy Now! Is produced by Dan Coughlin. Dred Scott Keyes is our engineer in New York. Andy York is our engineer in Washington, D.C. If you'd like a copy of today's show, you can call 1-800-735-0230. Julie Drizin, our executive producer. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening.